This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/sword.
This podcast is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
Number 76. I'm Veronica Belmont.
And I'm Tom Merritt.
And this is a sci-fi fantasy podcast where we discuss the books we're reading, talk about stuff going on in the sci-fi fantasy world, in film, TV, movies. Not that movies and film are that different. Video games.
We've got a book pick coming up at the very end of this podcast that involves all of those things in one.
Oh, good
point. Lovely plot. Yeah.
I did that on purpose.
Mm-hmm, you totally did.
Of course.
You're not nervous at all about our special guest today.
I am. No, not at all. I am not nervous at all. Can you tell?
Your idol.
Well, not my idol. Like, I'm not trying to be him or to someday become him.
No, I guess that's
like
not
some kind of shapeshifter.
I didn't mean you wanted to like become Tad Williams, but from the beginning of this podcast, you've always mentioned Tad Williams as one of your favorite authors.
Well, as I'm sure I will bring up during the interview, Tad Williams is in fact one of the very first fantasy authors I ever read, possibly even the first. Tail Chaser Song was a book that my dad gave to me when I was very young, and it really kind of kindled my love for the fantasy genre and hence this podcast. So in a
Yeah.
Tad Williams is kind of responsible for the Sword and Laser, kind of.
He's the godfather of Sword and Laser.
All right. I'll be sure to tell him that, in some kind of awkward fashion during the interview.
We'll be talking to him a little later in the episode, mm-hmm. but first we need to get to some quick burns. I actually saw this happen because I didn't watch the entire Emmys, but I did watch this part where they awarded Peter Dinklage an Emmy.
Huzzah! Very exciting. Well-deserved, in my opinion. Although some blogs are saying, you know, it was a coup. It was, you know, not expected. But I think it totally was. He did a great job in this season of Game of Thrones, and particularly the scene he was nominated for, which was his admittance of his previous issues with women in terms of, you know, getting married and finding out some certain things about his wife.
Yeah, so he won the award for Outstanding Supporting Performance in a Drama Series and gave a very, I thought it was a rather humble acceptance speech.
He was joking around that he thanked his dog walker instead of his manager or anyone like that. But if you think about it, it's the people in your life day to day, too.
Yeah, somebody's not watching your dogs. You can't go accept your Emmy.
And another Game of Thrones news, The Mountain has been recast. Plus, we've got some new villains that are very Arya-specific for the next season, which I think will be pretty exciting. Ian White, who's actually a 7-foot-1-inch-tall former professional basketball player, is going to be replacing Conan Stevens, who was Sir Gregor Clegane in the first two episodes of the first season. In two episodes in the first season.
Exactly. Stevens had some scheduling problems so that they just couldn't work out. And it doesn't sound like it's any bad blood or anything, but he got a chance to be on The Hobbit. So playing an orc chieftain, trumped playing Sir Gregor Clegane, I guess. And now we have Ian White instead.
Kind of funny, actually. The Hobbit is the cause of a lot of casting situations in
Sucking
Hollywood.
Up all the talent in the room.
Yeah. I'm not sure how many of you guys play Uncharted or the Uncharted series, but one of the actors who actually plays Sully in the Uncharted series, he is cast in The Hobbit as well. And so they had a hard time getting him scheduled for coming in to do voiceover sessions and mocap sessions for Uncharted 3 because of his shooting The Hobbit.
And then Andy Beckwith, who's probably best known as Errol from the movie Snatch, will be playing the role of Rorg. He's one of those guys that gets thrown in the wagon to be part of the Night's Watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a few people. Biter has been cast, and also the Tickler. So some of the very important villains from that
Gerard
second book. Gerard
Jordan is Biter, and who's playing the Tickler? Anthony Morris, I think.
Yes. Yeah. So, good stuff. And then some Cimmerillion news, interestingly enough.
This is really interesting. A German art student by the name of Benjamin Harf created an illuminated manuscript of the Silmarillion. So in total medieval style, this was part of his course at the Academy of Arts in Hennef, Germany, which I'm sure I'm mispronouncing. But the Tolkien Library website has an extensive interview with him, and he has only got the one copy. He's pursuing HarperCollins and the Tolkien estate to see if they would be willing to allow him to make a commercial application. Even if he did, I'm sure it would be a little pricey. It is gorgeous looking, though.
Yeah, what a cool project. And then finally, some Sword and Laser news. We are going to be visiting an event called An Evening with Neal Stephenson this coming Wednesday night. That is September 21st at 7:30 p.m. at the Swedish American Hall. Neal Stephenson is going to be talking about his new book, Reamed. And a lot of Sword and Laser people are going to be there, including some other people from the tech world, like Molly Wood.
Oh, right. I saw that. It's cool to see Molly.
So I'm excited to see her, and I'm excited to
I'm still excited to see
again.
Josh Lawrence, too, though.
Yeah, that old Josh Lawrence. Haven't
I've
seen him since
Josh
Dragon
more
Con.
Recently. Yeah, exactly.
So it'll be a fun night. There are still tickets available. In fact, I believe they dropped the entry price.
Yeah,
I
they
think
did.
Josh
you
told
don't
me that.
Get the book with the cheaper entry price. That's the deal.
It was something like $12 or something really, really low, which is good.
Yeah.
So hopefully if you're in the Bay Area and you can make it out, RSVP on the Goodreads forum under the events column, and we'll see you there.
Which leads us to the calendar, September 20th being the day of release for a couple of books, one being Reamed by Neal Stephenson. If you for some reason haven't heard, Richard Forthrast has parlayed a small fortune into a massive one using a wildly popular MMORPG called Terrain. And of course, any wildly popular online platform immediately attracts criminal attention, and a group of Chinese hackers build a devastating virus called Reamed, which gives the novel its name.
Also on the 20th, we have Goliath by Scott Westerfield. Westerfield's fabulous dieselpunk trilogy concludes in September with Goliath. The Leviathan is headed for New York City, with Alex still struggling to regain his rightful position as Austrian Archduke, and Darren still working to keep her gender under wraps.
Oops.
Can they navigate the geopolitical mess that is the 1910s? Can they hash out their own feelings? Mm. Also, Nikola Tesla makes an appearance.
The Islanders by Christopher Priest releases on September 22nd. It's Priest's first novel in about a decade and returns to the Dream Archipelago, the setting of the titular short story collection, and The Affirmation, one of his finest novels. The Islanders is now one of the most anticipated novels of the year, and Wurtzone said it was his top tip for 2011, since even if it's just half as good as its predecessor, it should be the best book of the year, according to Adam.
And on the 27th, another priest is having a book come out, Sherry Priest, with Tor for Ganymede. Andel Sly returns. This giant strapping pilot aims to clean up his act a bit, or at least quit the sap running. He heads for New Orleans to procure some supplies for Seattle, where he runs into former lady love Josephine Early. Now a madame and a Union spy, she's got an offer for Cly.
September 27th, The Hum and the Shiver by Alex Bledsoe. Wounded vet Bronwyn Hyatt comes back from Iraq to East Tennessee to the Insular family. They're not just mountain folk, though. They're the Tufa, an enigmatic fairy race with origins so remote even they don't remember where they came from. So you can guess the story is going to get interesting from there.
And also on the 27th, The Immorality Engine by George Mann. On the surface, life is going well for Victorian special agent Sir Maurice Newberry, who has brilliantly solved several nigh impossible cases for Queen Victoria with his indomitable assistant, Miss Veronica Hobbs, by his side. I just like it because there's a character named Veronica, and also more Victorian era steampunkiness, perhaps?
Yeah, exactly. Good stuff. October 1st, Manhattan in Reverse by good old Peter F. Hamilton. His next novel is not due until 2012, but in the meantime, you get this collection of short fiction to get you through. The volume collects Hamilton's short fiction from the last decade or so, including some stories set in the Commonwealth setting. So you may have run across these stories, but at least they're all collected in one place, so you can find out if you like them all.
Very cool. So now it's time to thank our sponsor. This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. The internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many of the New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you the chance to try out their service. So what are we recommending this week?
Well, I was looking around and it seems that, I don't know, have you ever heard of a series called Shadow March?
I think I have heard of that series.
If you were interested in it, it's by a guy named Tad Williams, and you can get the whole series on Audible. So, you know, you don't have to listen to it all at once, but you could start out with the free volume one. Ooh. With our audiblepodcast.com/sword, and then you would get a chance to try it out, see if you like not only Audible, but the Shadow March series as well, narrated by Dick Hill. So that's just one possible book. You can pick whatever book you want. For free, just go to audiblepodcast.com/sword. And if you're already an Audible user, like I know a lot of you are, tell a friend. Let them know that they can use that URL to get a free audiobook.
Yeah, we've been. I've been very thankful of people who have been writing on Twitter to audible_com, telling us that they found their service through Sword and Laser and what they're listening to. So that's a really awesome way to kind of let them know that we're bringing you to Audible and exposing you to some cool stuff.
Excellent. Well, shall we dial up Mr. Tad Williams?
Yes, we shall. Bay Area-based Tad Williams is the author of many outstanding books, including several series such as Memory, Sorrow, and Thorn, Otherland, and Shadow March. On a personal note, his novel Tale Chaser's Song was the book that basically got me interested in fantasy in the first place. So thank you so much for joining us, Tad.
That's a heck of a burden for one man to shoulder.
No pressure.
Earlier in the show, Veronica was calling you the godfather of Sword and Laser.
No, you said that.
Okay, well, we don't have to decide who said it. I'll just sit here and bask in the embarrassment of
No, I was saying, well, if I had never gotten into fantasy, we never would have started Sword and Laser. And, you know, it kind of worked that way. Anyway, now I'm embarrassed and blushing, so we should just get right into the questions.
All right, I'll start the first question, comes from Jenny on our Goodreads forum. And she asks, what book would he suggest a Tad Williams virgin start with?
Well, I think that probably depends on the age of the Tad Williams virgin in question. If we're talking young, we are now writing, my wife Deborah Beale and I are writing all ages fantasy novels, The Dragons of Ordinary Farm being the first one. And that certainly is a good place to start. Tale Chaser Song is still, despite the crippling effect it had on Veronica, it's still to be found in many school libraries. So that's a good one for the sort of more middle ages readers. If you wanted to come in as a grown-up, it might be easiest to try something like War of the Flowers just because it's complete in one volume. It gives you a kind of a feeling, a kind of a flavor of the kind of stuff I like to do, but you don't have to sort of strap on and wade through three very long or four very long volumes as you do with many of the other things. I think, by the way, the thing I'm doing now, which we may talk about later, is also going to be a fairly good introduction to my work.
Great. Next, Tom Ahome wanted to know, how do you decide how long a book will be? Do publishers pressure you to make them longer?
Well, yeah, actually, it is interesting because in the old days, of course, the tradition, you know, the normal thing was that, you know, publishers were always going, cut it down, smaller, shorter. The weird thing about epic fantasy is, although this may be changing now, as so many other things are in our field, but the weird thing about epic fantasy is publishers definitely are perfectly happy with longish books. And certainly the way I write, my publishers, particularly my American publishers, who tend to be also my editors, oftentimes will say to me, well, you need to, you know, go into greater depth with this bit, or, you know, this character needs to be fleshed out a little more, or, gee, this is a really significant emotional moment, and, you know, it feels like it could go a little longer. So very seldom have I ever been asked to cut stuff. Now, you know, there may be people who think that's a crime that I haven't been asked to cut more. But, you know, in general, though, the feeling is, you know, these are big books. The people who buy them and read them like the size and the sweep of them. So, you know, just make sure that it's you know, that you get everything out of it all the way through.
So I have a quick question. I know that when you were hosting the George R. R. Martin chat recently here in the Bay Area, he made a joke that you had a trilogy that then turned into more books. Which series was he talking about?
Well, in a way, kind of all of them, really. The Memory, Sorrow, and Thorn books, of which the first book is The Dragonbone Chair, that was my first big epic, and I promised that that was going to be a trilogy. I actually thought it was going to be a single volume when I started, and my publishers disabused me of that notion by pointing out that my outline itself was already 125 pages, and it contained lots of bits where it said things like, and then some other stuff will happen, which I'll figure out later. So it was clearly not going to be a single volume. But what happened was I promised it would be three volumes. And as a result, when I got to start the third volume, which eventually was called To Green Angel Tower, the sheep, as it were, had strayed all over the hillside in terms of all the plot strands and the characters and things like that. And it took me a massive last volume to bring it all back into place. And that last volume was, in fact, so large. It was like 1,200 very skinny pages in hardcover that it had to be divided into two books. Now, Otherland, I started out as a trilogy knowing that I would do the same thing. So I just made it four books from the beginning. So that was my four-book trilogy that I never pretended was going to be three books. Shadow March, though, was I felt very firmly would be three volumes. And then I got into the middle of the third volume, and it was so long and complicated that I'd have to make people wait another year, year and a half to read it. And it would be another monstrous volume, like the last of the Memory, Sorrow, and Thorn books. And so I reluctantly decided to chop that into two books as well. So Shadow March was another trilogy that became a tetralogy. So I've had some problems.
Noticing a trend, for sure.
Yeah.
Do you feel grateful to Douglas Adams for helping to popularize just breaking trilogy form?
Yeah, I do in one sense, but of course I've had that thrown in my face now so many times. It's good that people have a sense of humor about it. I will point out that unlike some of my contemporaries, I've actually finished all of these stories.
Right.
No offense to George, he's a fabulous writer, and however long he wants to take, I'm sure is fine with everybody because it's a great story. But
it's always worth the wait. I agree. Terp Kristen asks our next question. She says, what do you think influences your writing, other authors, other works, etc.?
Oh, all of the above. What I find influences me most of all is probably the things that I read and fell in love with when I was young. And that really is a very broad spectrum. I mean, that's everything from A.A. Milne to, you know, Stan Lee, Jack Kirby comics, to, you know, the writers I discovered a little bit later on when I became a serious book reader when I was, you know, 11, 12, which is Tolkien and all of the great fantasy and science fiction writers of that time, Bradbury, Sturgeon, Ursula Le Guin, zillions of folks. And so that all is kind of in there in me. And I have to be very careful sometimes when something comes to me too quickly. I have to kind of pull it out and go, am I stealing that from Michael Moorcock, you know, from when I was 13 or 14 years old? It's just way in the back of my mind. But as I've gotten older, of course, not only have the kind of wider spread of influences have crept in terms of other writers and other kinds of writing, I became very, very interested in history and science, and those things began to trickle in. And I would say even more than that, though, now, I really spend a lot of my time kind of watching and thinking. And that now is probably the single biggest influence on what I do is what I see. You know, so in a sense, I kind of, as we all do, I learned by absorbing influences when I was young, and now I kind of refine those influences by measuring them up against the real world and seeing how they match up, whether they are good lenses to look at things, whether I need to refine those lenses, maybe I need to develop an entirely new kind of lens to deal with the ideas that I'm interested in. So really all of that stuff.
Terp Kristen then goes on to ask, do you plan out your books and series in advance, or do they kind of end up taking on a life of their own as you continue writing?
Well, as I mentioned before, there are some ways.
Apparently, yes.
Yeah, it's a bit of a Frankensteinian endeavor. But one of the really interesting things about writing big books, and you learn this very quickly, at least I did, is that order arises out of complexity. And if you create a complex enough environment and you try to make your characters and your settings and, in fact, your plots fairly organic, meaning that things proceed logically from one step to the next instead of all being forced by the author, they really are, you know, almost alive. There's things pop up that you don't expect. So on the one hand, it's very important to stay open to that. Also, just as I said, you know, you watch, you listen, and you learn from the world around you, and you have to be open to that too, to making a discovery, you know, just serendipity, where you're standing in line behind somebody at a store, and they say something, and it sends you off on a whole new path. Wow, I hadn't even thought about, what if that, and blah, you know, and back and forth, and so, but you cannot, I can't anyway, I can't simply do it just that way. I can't just sit down and let the story go. I'm too much of a structuralist for that. And in fact, a lot of my frustration with other books, often books that I've really enjoyed, is that the structure was not strong enough for me, that it was kind of meandering, that clearly the writer was relying on inspiration, and that leads to some brilliant ideas. But also, you know, that the only place where we really know that we are in the control of a larger power and hopefully fairly benign larger power. The only place where we know that for absolutely scientifically certain is when we're reading fiction. And that, you know, hopefully benign larger power is the writer of that, or the creator of that world. So I feel, you know, I want to exert some of that control to shape the story, to make it do all the things that really good fiction can do. And so as a result, I have to plan some of it out ahead of time. You can't foreshadow in a first volume for things that are going to happen in a third volume unless you have some idea of what those things are. You're just doomed otherwise. You're never going to be able to foreshadow, and therefore you give up part of the most interesting things about – some of the most interesting things about fiction, you know, which is the thematic references and the setups and the foreshadowings and all the things that – when woven together, make a really interesting piece of storytelling. So what happens is you have these sort of twin poles, I guess, or whatever you want to call it, that are pulling you two different directions. Total spontaneity and the need for total, you know, control of your structure. And for me, especially with big books, it's kind of a tightrope walk between those two to mix it. Just absolutely ghastly metaphor. You know, you're kind of got those things pulling you on either side, and you're trying to go between them and find the appropriate distance where neither one takes over the process.
Do you have like a physical way that you actually map out the storylines? Do you have like a pin board? Do you just keep everything on your computer? What's your method like?
It's sort of oval shaped. It's mostly flesh colored, and it's on top of my neck. And it's not everybody's first choice for something they'd like to have around their office, but it's what I've got, and it's my head. I pretty much do it in my head. I find that there are occasionally times when I have many, many, many plot lines all intersecting, and things like the chronology are crucial, that something has to happen, but the character has to not know this, which they're going to find out later. So although that thing has to happen to them, it has to happen without telling them about such and such, because meanwhile over here, you know, those kinds of things where you're really working with complex interactions of plot lines and characters. Then I will occasionally jot down some notes just to see if I've kind of got it in the right order and if the reader is going to get the information in the order that they need to understand what's going on. But as for the rest of it, as for the sort of the bigger planning and the looking for inspiration and the formulating the story and solving most of the day-to-day writing problems, I find that if I just keep it in my head, it works better. And I think part of that is because as soon as I start writing things down, they begin to become real, and therefore they are harder to unthink. Mm. Whereas if it's just in my mind and I've got a cloud, and I think of it very much that way, like a quantum cloud. If I've got a cloud of possibilities in my head, I can sort of move them around, shift them, connect them, unconnect them, and all of that in a very fluid way that allows me to try a lot of different things very quickly. So that's really, I guess, it. I mean, most of it I do it in my head because I don't think at this point there is a an algorithm or a program or a pegboard or anything else that I could do that would work as well for me.
Someone who calls themselves Officer Friendly on our Goodreads forum wants to know what kind of feedback you may have received from Shakespeare types after the release of Caliban's Hour, and then wonders if you needed permission from the estate to write the novel.
No. I, as far as I know, there is no Shakespeare estate. If there,
thank
if
goodness.
There is, I'm way down the list of people they're going to be going after. One of the interesting things for me about writing that book, the Tempest is, for those who don't know what we're talking about Caliban's Hour, which is a sort of prequel and sequel to The Tempest, told from the point of view of the monster, so-called, from the play, Caliban. And I really enjoyed writing that, and it is my favorite Shakespeare play. And it actually came out originally in England during – there was some big Shakespeare – I don't know what it was, the quincentennial or so. I'm not sure what it was.
Big anniversary of some kind.
Yeah, some big Shakespeare anniversary. And but I got remarkably little attention for that book. And that's always one of the things that's made me not sad, but I've always said that's too bad, because I thought there were ideas in there that were worth, being measured up against some of the other, examinations of Shakespeare in fiction. And so, no, I haven't. I've never, certainly never heard any purists protest about it. And most of the people I know who've read it have just, kind of said, "Oh, that was neat," or whatever, which is great. Don't get me wrong, but I would have loved to have somebody said, "Well, how dare you cast Prospero as a such and such?" Or I think that's probably the kind of tragic tale of my career, is I'm always waiting for these heavyweight critical responses, and I don't get as many of them. Because, by God, I certainly put that amount of work into it and that thought into it on my end. And then I get this kind of like, well, pretty good for Tolkien type fantasy or, whatever. And you feel like, okay, could be worse.
That's the worst you got for me? Come on.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, actually, to kind of take it in that direction for a second. Do you feel that fantasy writers sometimes get the, to put it mildly, the shit end of the stick when it comes from professional reviewers who maybe don't look at it in the same regard as traditional fiction?
Virtually all writers of genre fiction get that unpleasant end of the proverbial stick. And one of the reasons, of course, is because there's always a confusion as to what genre means. And without going into too much detail and boring the tears out of people, there's a confusion between genre meaning a commercial genre and genre meaning a style or type of fiction. And certainly, it's been very hard in fantasy to separate those two for a lot of reviewers, because what they see, as in many types of genre fiction, is a bunch of books that follow sort of the conventions of a very popular predecessor. In epic fantasy, obviously, Lord of the Rings. Just as in crime fiction, it's, after Raymond Chandler, or in, mystery fiction, it follows Agatha Christie and Conan Doyle. Which is fine. That is, in fact, part of what a genre is. It's a set of conventions, just like ballet is a set of conventions, but the difference is, of course, is that they're confusing those conventions and the structure that people put on their fiction with the rest of the meaning of the word genre, which is the commercial side, which is basically whatever the market will bear. And when something is popular, you'll get gazillions of versions of that because there's a market for it. And unfortunately, just as with everything else in genre, whether Westerns or mysteries or whatever, like Sturgeon said, 90% of everything is crap. So of course, if most of it's being written just to fill a marketplace, just to sell to people who just want something with a dragon on the cover, of course most of it's crap, but that doesn't mean that there aren't people, and we can all name names, but there aren't people in our fields who aren't writing brilliant things, you know? And I'm not putting myself in that company. I'm just saying that's certainly what I've aspired to, is to writing genuine, you know, real books that just happen to be in this genre because I like the genre. So, you know, yeah, of course. And when you're dealing with people outside the genre, it's very hard for them to get past the, you know, the zillions and zillions of bad Tolkien knockoffs and, you know, as my friend Peter Stamfels calls them, Elf Girl in the Forest books and, you know, all these other kinds of things that make up a genre. Just like, you know, it's difficult to get past, you know, it might be difficult for some people to get past all the terrible 1950s TV westerns to appreciate John Ford's best work or something. But for some reason, you know, some of these things do make their way past the critical circle, like crime fiction has. And after that point, then the good writers are more likely to be noticed.
So Skip wants to know, also kind of related to what we were just talking about, what do you like to read outside of the fantasy genre?
Well, that's always a hard question to answer because I kind of like to read all kinds of stuff. I'm forced by my work to read an awful lot of nonfiction. So first of all, that's kind of the, you know, most of what you'll see on my bedside shelf at any one time is all the stuff that I'm reading for what I'm working on. At the moment, it's all, you know, eschatology and hell and heaven and angelology and all kinds of stuff like that. During other books, it's, you know, a whole different set of things. And then plus I read other kinds of nonfiction just for fun because I'm interested in them, especially science for dummies because, you know, I'm not a trained scientist, but I'm fascinated by most branches.
Oh, so like James Gleick kind of.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I love that stuff too.
I like Mary Roach. She's one of my favorites who kind of delves into the science area.
Ooh, I don't know Mary Roach. That's exciting. I'll have to go and track down her work.
Yeah, she's great. She's also very, very funny.
Thank you for the tip. That's excellent. So on the one hand, you know, I've got a lot of nonfiction around. In terms of fiction, I actually don't read a huge amount of stuff in my own field. And not just because of Sturgeon's Law, but also because you know, when you're writing this stuff, there's only so much time you want to spend with it yourself, you know. So I have favorite writers, and if I see they've got something out, I'll read that. But I also read a lot of other kinds of fiction as well, you know, everything from, really everything. But I mean, you know, Regency fiction, crime fiction, modern fiction. I mean, you kind of name it, I'm all over the place. I read some poetry. You know, read short stories out of the New Yorker. I mean, just whatever is there. I'm a reader. I grew up as a reader. It's astonishing to me in retrospect that it took me so long to realize I was born to be a writer because, you know, my family reading was kind of the main thing that everybody shared was our interest in books and stories. So I really, you know, I will read virtually everything. I have lots of favorites. You know, only a few of them are only some of them are fantasy and science fiction writers. So, you know, all over the shop.
All right, let's finish up with talking a little bit about what you're working on now. What are all these angels and eschatology books that you're reading on?
Well, I've just finished, actually, the first draft, which for me is about 90% of the work, of my next book, which is the first of what will be a kind of an unnumbered series, although for the sake of entertainment, I'm calling it another trilogy. but it's what the idea with these is the basically it's kind of it's angel noir, I guess. The main character of these books is an earthbound angel whose name is, well, his angel name is Deloriel. His earth name is Bobby Dollar. He's an advocate for the newly dead, but because he's the person who goes out and argues after somebody dies whether that they should go to heaven versus a satanic prosecutor, he lives on Earth. He lives with humans, et cetera, et cetera. However, because of the nature of this kind of a story, it's not just crime fiction type stuff, fantastical crime fiction. It's also, it's a cold war going on between heaven and hell, and it's been going on for a very long time. And there is that element in it as well of you don't really know who your allies are, even though it should be obvious and things like that. And so in the first book, which is called The Dirty Streets of Heaven, Bobby stumbles into something that is clearly unusual, which in this case is a soul that after the person dies disappears. It doesn't show up to be judged. It doesn't wind up in heaven. It doesn't wind up in hell. And he, because it was his case, throws himself into trying to find out what's going on, and it just gets weird quickly. And he rapidly finds himself in a very, very difficult situation and very unsure of who his allies are. And then I'm just also, while I'm finishing up that one, I'm starting the second one, which is called Happy Hour in Hell. And the third one will be called Sleeping Late on Judgment Day. But the difference between these and some of the other things I've written is that, for one thing, they're shorter than my regular books, maybe like half the length or so, you know, kind of more normal novel length, and sort instead of the steroidal monstrosities I normally produce. And they're also meant to be books that, although if you read them from beginning to end, they will, you know, make the most sense, that unlike my other books, they're not a single story. Each one can stand on its own. So you could actually pick up one of the later books and read it. And just from the little bits of conversation in the book, you could figure out what you need to know and enjoy that book by itself, and then go back and read the other one if you wanted to, but you wouldn't have to, you know, and that way also more like crime fiction. And, oh, and my wife always tells me that I have to explain that one of the other things is during the course of the first book, he Bobby falls in love. And unfortunately, he falls in love with somebody working for the other side.
Oh.
It's, you know, your classic.
A tragic romance.
Yeah, yeah. It's not a meet cute situation at all, but it is a tragic romance. So that's basically what they are. So we call them the Bobby Dollar books, or we call them the Angel books, or whatever. And so I'm very deep in that because, of course, me being me and being fascinated by the things that fascinate me, I can't try to create a universe in which this stuff happens without trying to figure out how it works. And let me tell you, people have been arguing about this for thousands of years. So there's a lot of ways to go and a lot of things to consider. And it raises questions about my own, you know, ideas about the cosmos and the purpose of life and all this kind of stuff. So it's been fascinating, but it's also, you know, it's one of those things where every time you read something or research something, you find five more things that you have to look into.
That's interesting because we just finished reading Flash Forward, and that has a very hard science fiction element to it. So a lot of the stuff that they talk about in the book is definitely rooted in fact. So in a way, you're kind of writing hard fantasy in a sense.
Oh, I think in a lot of ways I always have been a writer of hard fantasy. It's just that the term didn't exist before. But I've always been one of those people who gets really frustrated when characters, you know, wander around for days and weeks on end and nobody explains what they eat or how they get from one place to another or, you know, any of that kind of stuff. So, yeah. And this also, not only does it have those elements, which are fun to play with, which is how does it really work, or at least how does it seem to work, but also, you know, I have the chance to maybe piss off thousands and hundreds of thousands of people with my ideas about the religious truths behind the cosmos. So that's kind of exciting, too.
You're dead set on getting somebody to get controversial and come back at you, huh?
Well, as long as it stops somewhere short of my martyrdom, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. When do you expect the books to be ready to read?
I would think the first book will be out sometime in the first half of next year. As I said, it's basically finished. I just have to go through the editorial process and you know, all that kind of stuff. So.
Fantastic. Well, we'll have to check that out for the book club. I haven't gotten us to read a Tad Williams novel yet, so.
It's long overdue.
Yes, indeed. So thank you so much for joining us. Where can people follow your work and updates online?
Well, we have, first of all, my regular website, which is tadwilliams.com. We really thought long and hard about that one, come up with a real, you know, catchy name. And of course, I'm also the equivalent of the town drunk on Facebook. So you can find me there, and anybody who wants to can friend me. I friend everybody, and then you're stuck with me. So
can't wait for the next book. And again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica. Thank you, Tom.
Great interview. Thank you again to Tad Williams for coming on the show. It was just awesome to get to chat with him for a little bit.
I love the authors that we have been getting on Sword and Laser. I feel so privileged that they're willing to take the time to chat with us. And they're always so nice and smart and interesting. It's great stuff.
Indeed. And if there's anyone you think we should be talking to, let us know by emailing us at theswordandlaser@gmail.com. Speaking of email, we have quite a few this week. One coming from Kevin Hansen. He writes, in your discussion on the use of German in Flash Forward, I cringe when you pronounce Jawohl. It is pronounced like Jawohl and is something you would expect to hear on Hogan's Heroes reruns or in the phrase Jawohl, mein Herr.
Jawohl, mein Herr.
That's probably a little bit better than what I did. But I never heard it in Germany when I lived there for several months in the mid-80s. Love your podcast, though.
I was so lazy when I said that. I apologize to German speakers. Not that I can pronounce it like a real German, but I could have done better.
Well, fortunately, we do know someone who natively speaks the German language. And so I pinged her on Goodreads and asked Anne to send in the correct pronunciation. Here she is.
Hello everyone, this is Anne from the Goodreads forum. A few of you may know me or you may not. Veronica asked me to provide the correct German pronunciation of a word that was talked about in one of the last episodes for the novel Flash Forward. And the word is Jawohl, and you spell it J-A-W-O-H-L, and you pronounce it Jawohl, or you can do a more mockingly, ironically pronunciation, and that would be Jawohl. But that could also be just the region where I come from and the way I learned it in my family, so not completely sure if that's true for all of Germany or German-speaking countries. There were also two names that were mentioned, and I think I'll include them in this pronunciation guide, and those were Helmut and Wolfgang. And that's how you pronounce those correctly. So everyone have a great day. Enjoy listening to the podcast and bye.
That was so cool to get to hear Anne and then get corrected by her.
She is the
now
best.
Now I know. Yes.
And also,
thank you, Anne.
If you want to see Anne in person, we have a link on the blog of her playing ukulele and playing the Sword and Laser theme on the ukulele.
Because
she is
rocks.
A badass like that.
She is. There is nothing can stop Anne.
Nothing can stop her. And speaking of pronunciations, we actually have a really great thread started in the Goodreads forums by Zenfi, wondering how to say sword and laser in many different kinds of languages. Because as you remember, I kind of botched trying to say it in Spanish in the last episode. So apparently in Spanish, it's espada y laser, or laser, laser. Espada y laser.
I'm so afraid to read any of these, but I'll try the French, which would be épée et laser.
Oh, man, this is not going to be good. Anne said it in German. I don't know how to say it. I'm not even going to try. But if you're curious to see at least how they're written out, Allah wanted to note that in idiot, it's swish and pew pew.
In Russian, Vladimir writes mich i laser.
Oh, man, these are hard. I'm sorry. I'm not very well versed in many different
languages. Try the Swedish one.
Where's the Swedish? Hold on. I don't know where
it's
it is.
It's Jenny's message 10.
Oh, svardak laser.
Yeah.
Svard. Svardak laser. Svard and laser is
anyway,
Dutch.
Anyway, our apologies to you for mangling your native languages, but thank you, everyone, for the translations. That was awesome.
I'm partial to swish and pew pew.
What's that, idiots?
Yeah, that's the idiot translation.
That's great.
Or more of that like zoom sound that a lightsaber makes, like zoom, zoom. Oh, actually, that's laser. Yeah, you're right. I'm like a swing, swing, and pew, pew. Anyway, that's all I have for this episode in me right now. But let's say hello to some of the new members. Not too many of you this week. But if you want to go ahead and read them, Tom.
Gant, AJ, Michael, Joseph, Adam, and Derek. Welcome.
Welcome.
To bienvenidos. The
I can say that much. Well, we do have a new book announcement. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. We'll do a proper kickoff next week because we wanted to take time to talk to Ted Williams this week. But Ready Player One, we hashed out without Veronica's knowledge on the Goodreads forum.
Yeah, I don't know when did this happen, but okay. I'm okay.
It was over
with
the
it.
Weekend. It was in a thread.
I see.
I was representing your dictatorial interests. and Ready Player One by Ernest Cline. Fantastic book. About an online world called the Oasis, and there's an Easter egg hunt that is put in place by the programmer of the Oasis, the kickoff after he dies. Whoever finds the three keys will win much money and controlling interest in the Oasis itself. It's kind of a post-apocalyptic future world. And if you like 80s television, movies, video games, any kind of sci-fi fantasy references at all, you're going to absolutely love this book. Some of the people on the forums have pointed out that there's some plot holes here and there, and maybe they're right. But honestly, I'm absolutely digging it because of the excellent references that are woven into this story to make sense. Everything from Atari 2600 games to family ties to Lady Hawk to war games and John Hughes movies. You name it. It is an opus to the 80s, but set in the future with a very futuristic plot. So that is our book for next time. And then an alternate selection, obviously, be Neal Stephenson's Ream, because we know a lot of you are going to read it anyway, as we are.
And speaking of early 80s TV shows or 80s TV shows, actually, maybe it's not an 80s TV show. Never mind. Speaking of 80s child actors, Will Wheaton also narrates the audiobook.
Yeah, that's right. And he's actually mentioned in the book at one time, which is
really,
yeah, it was pretty interesting because he's an old geezer in the 2040s when the book takes place.
Gotcha. Very cool. All right. Well, if you guys want to get in touch with us, the email address is theswordandlaser@gmail.com. The website, as always, is swordandlaser.com. And all of our discussions happen over on goodreads.com, or you can click the discussion tab from the blog. We will see you guys next time.
Bye.
Bye.